Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. 10 years ago in Charlotte, the bank then known as Wachovia was well on its way to falling apart.
Wachovia, the nation's fourth largest bank, said it lost close to $9 billion in the second quarter. That sobering announcement also included news that the bank will cut more than 6,000 jobs.
Wachovia was hit by a $5 billion run on deposits last month after the failure of its West Coast rival, Washington Mutual.
Wachovia's stock price is down around $5 a share.
Earlier in the summer of 2008, CEO Ken Thompson resigned under pressure. And by the end of the year, the nation's fourth largest bank would be gobbled up by Wells Fargo. In September of 2008, Lehman Brothers collapsed, igniting what became the Great Recession. Subprime mortgages and the risky securities repackaged and built on those mortgages crippled financial markets. In the U.S., unemployment doubled, and Americans lost trillions of dollars as the stock market plunged. Since then, in many ways, the economy has soared. Unemployment hovers near record lows. The stock market has reached new highs. And Apple recently became the first company to be valued at $1 trillion. That's trillion with a T. And yet, a budding trade war, recession complacency, and other factors have stirred anxiety. Adam Tooze, an historian at Columbia University, is among those who is watching these warning signs. His new book is called Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And he joins me today by phone. Professor Tooze, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's start with what you discovered along the way as you were working on this book. Early on, you expected to write a book exploring what you describe as the financial diplomacy that rescued the American economy and much of the world's. But you say that that series of events now has a more ominous meaning. How did you arrive at that conclusion, and what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the story has changed as history has evolved, and this is a typical problem for a historian, and it's one of the reasons why people, generally speaking, take time to write history. So it was a risk that I was running in undertaking this project. You're right, when I started doing it in 2012, 2013, it looked as though we had closure on this story. The financial crisis in the United States had been tamed, and then in the summer of 2012, the aftershock in the Eurozone in Europe had been tamed as well. Barack Obama was reelected in November 2012. Whatever you think of that, in political terms, it put a kind of narrative closure on the 4 years of crisis fighting. The crisis fighters and those who'd inherited the Republican crisis fighting of 2008 were confirmed in office. There was a sense in which there was a coherent narrative here. And it did, in fact, at that moment, look as though it was a narrative of America having successfully stabilized its own economy and then contributed significantly to stabilizing Europe as well. What comes next are a whole series of shocks, which I think have overturned common sense views about how both the economy and politics of the modern world will function. So in Europe, on the boundaries of Europe, we have the crisis in Ukraine, which spills over into a frozen war. We have the return of the debt crisis in Europe with the second phase of the Greek crisis. We have the shock of the Brexit referendum. And then for the political elite of most of the Western world, the shocking result of Donald Trump's election as American president in the fall of 2016. So that series of developments, which were not anticipated in 2012, 2013, is what made writing the book both fascinating and, in a sense, very unsettling.
One of the themes that you hit again and again in this book is that what happened in 2008 and the years going forward really set the table for the rise of a figure such as President Trump. Explain a little bit what you mean by that.
Well, I think one could point to the three dimensions of this. I mean, one is that Trump himself is a survivor of crisis. I mean, he's a businessman who's been rocked both by the personal troubles of his businesses and by the business cycle in the United States. It's easily forgotten that in 2008, he was a real estate developer with a very big condo building in Chicago that was in deep trouble. He had large outstanding loans, not to an American bank, but to Deutsche Bank, his main financier in New York. Donald Trump was a victim, you might say, of the crisis, and a very active advocate of the kind of bailout that was necessary in 08, 09, in his view and in the view of most other experts around the world to stabilize the U.S. economy. So that's one dimension of it. That, if you like, is the sort of radical pragmatism of Donald Trump, whatever it takes to get whatever the job is that he imagines needs doing done. So that's one element. And I think of him in that sense as a sort of classically post-crisis figure. He is not a doctrinaire market economist, as we're discovering. Another element of this is the rage and frustration of large parts of the American electorate, which we saw expressing itself on both wings of the political scene in 2016. One of the really surprising things is how far the 2016 election was about the 08 crisis, how much more it was than the 2012 election, where if you have an incumbent like Obama running against a challenger like Romney, who's least well-suited, if you arguably, to, as it were, represent a popular outrage at bankers, the issue is sort of rather shut down. But in 2016, it explodes onto the scene with both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party being shaken by radical challenges. And I think that's then the third element of this story. So you have the question of the leadership of Donald Trump himself. You have the question of the base. And then I think, crucially, you have the fractures that emerge within the Republican Party itself. I mean, it's a successful vote-winning organization, undeniably, across the United States. But in terms of ideological coherence, in terms of the coherence of leadership and base, it's a broken organization from 08 onwards. And there is It's hard to imagine a more graphic demonstration of that fact than the fact that the Republicans in Congress refused to back their own president at a moment of national crisis in 08 when the congressional leadership of the Republican Party couldn't turn out the votes either for the rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or passing TARP. Both those crucial crisis-fighting measures were passed with Democratic votes. So from that moment onwards, the GOP has become something other than a governing party. It's become a party of protest. It's a party in which people express their frustrations at the way the world is. But it doesn't look at that moment like a coherent political governing organization devoted to backing up its president in power at a moment of national crisis.
That's the voice of Adam Tooze. He is my guest today. He is the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. You just touched on some of this. Throughout the book, you make clear your belief that the federal government in the United States, in many ways, isn't willing to make meaningful economic reforms. And I wonder if you could go through maybe a few of the main reasons of why that continues and what's at risk by not taking action in that area.
Well, I think when we're talking about meaningful economic reforms, I think the crucial issue is to focus on banking. I mean, the banks, the big banks, the risks that had accumulated on the balance sheets of the big banks are really the trigger of the crisis. That is what turns this from being a bad case of the economic flu, a bit like the dot-com bubble bursting, to being a heart attack. And it's when the cardiovascular system of the economy, the banking sector, is in trouble that you really risk imminent and immediate death. And that's what we were facing in 08, 09. And the question really, when we come to radical reform, is was enough done to change that? And I think you could say that they tuned the system of regulation up. Dodd-Frank was a hodgepodge. It's a complete mess as a piece of legislation. But what it enabled people to do, regulators to do, was actually to squeeze the balance sheets of the banks quite aggressively. TARP and stress testing was quite effective in forcing them to take more capital as well. So they became fundamentally sounder institutions, but they're also fundamentally the same institutions. Other than the casualties, Lehman notably, and then those that were gobbled up in the merger wave, as you were saying, Bacovia swallowed up by Wells Fargo, Merrill Lynch by Bank of America, there's no fundamental change. If anything, in fact, America's banks got bigger. So as entities and as problems of government, because they are so large that they do indeed pose risks to the system, the entirety, the public of the United States, they remain fundamentally a standing risk. No structural change was brought about to reduce that. So it's a question of, how well we think we're going to be able to drive this machine. The machine remains fundamentally the same. Why? Why was there no more fundamental reform? Fundamental reform is difficult. It doesn't always work. There are risks involved in nationalizing a bank and attempting to break it up. And of course, there are very powerful interests at stake that have no interest in seeing that happen. And what is really striking is how cautiously the Obama administration proceeded. And it's not as though, you know, any its likely opponents, the Republicans, would have proceeded more aggressively, I think. But across the American political spectrum, there really was no appetite for an aggressive, that is, on the part of the political leadership in Washington, there was no appetite for a aggressive restructuring, say, of Citigroup or Bank of America, these enormous financial powerhouses that are very difficult for their own management to run, let alone an external regulator to oversee effectively.
So let's stay with the banking piece of this because, as no doubt you're aware, this is the headquarters of Bank of America, and Wells Fargo has its largest employee hub here in Charlotte. So banking is always top of mind here. Just a couple weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal was writing about this new Bank Policy Institute, which is, in essence, a group that is lobbying on behalf of Bank of America, Citigroup, and the other large banks to roll back some of the reform that was put in place, that hodgepodge you just talked about. So do you see this as a risk? Does it make much of a difference? How much unwinding do you think is going to occur in terms of the regulations that were put in place after the recession?
I think that the unwinding is going on, and it's quite fundamental. And it has to do with the nature of the reforms themselves, because passing legislation, as we all know, through Congress is a nightmarish job. It involves, you know, an endless, tiresome process of bargaining. It's extremely difficult to get any kind of clean conception of government through Congress. So the way in which Dodd-Frank was passed is a series of compromises, which basically gave as much discretion as they could squeeze into it to the regulators. And the regulators at that moment were coming out of the shock of 2008 and quite seriously minded, I think, to reduce the risk in the financial system, apart from anything else, because bailing out the financial system had proved so politically contentious and difficult for the authorities. So they simply wanted to minimize the risk of having to do that again. And what we're seeing right now, I don't think what we're going to see is legislative change. I think, you know, the Republicans and the Trump administration have plenty on their hands in that respect. And I don't think a flat-out effort to roll back Dodd-Frank, well, it may happen, but I think that would be the path of maximum resistance. The path of least resistance is simply to tinker with the criteria used by the regulators under their discretionary powers. So what we saw with the stress test this year were essentially a series of bargain deals whereby prominent banks were informed that they were likely to fail and then were asked to say what they were going to do about it. And then agreements were reached, if you like, outside the public eye between the banks and the regulators over what, you know, minimal measures the banks were would be required to take. And I think I have to say right now, I don't think of this as generating systemic risk. But I think what it's doing is, if you like, free riding. It's taking advantage of the substantial change and improvement to the balance sheets that was produced over the last 8 to 9 years and allowing the banks now, if you like, a much, much looser rein. So right now, the risks are not there on their balance sheets. But the question really is if the reins are loosened, if the leash is loosened as much as it looks as though the regulators want to loosen it, what risks might accumulate?
So I guess the warning lights are maybe not blinking red, but they are blinking a little bit in your view?
Yeah, it's as though we've turned the traffic lights off.
Well, we're not going to turn the lights off, but we're going to take a quick break here. We're speaking with Adam Tooze. He's the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to do a little forecasting, as any economist must do. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and we are speaking today with Adam Tooze. He is a professor of history and economics at Columbia University. He is the author of the new book, Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises changed the world. We were talking a little bit about the banks and what may happen with some of the regulations put in place. I want to go back a little bit into 2008. This is a 700-page book, so we can't get to everything, although I'd like to. But one of the things that really jumped out at me is you write about Ben Bernanke, who was the head of the Federal Reserve when the economy collapsed. And this is something that I hadn't really thought much about, which is that when Ben Bernanke was named or selected to run the Fed, it was viewed by many as sort of an afterthought. It didn't really get a lot of attention. And he ended up being obviously probably the most important person in terms of navigating the United States economy out of this mess. So tell me a little bit about why he was such an afterthought and why he was so important.
Well, I mean, Ben Bernanke, he was in a difficult spot. I mean, he was following, you know, one of the great maestros of economic policy of the late 20th century, Alan Greenspan, who himself had been successor to another legendary Fed chair, Paul Volcker. And so Greenspan was stepping into very big boots. Bernanke was stepping into very big boots when he was appointed. So this was a huge. The job had been given an enormous status. I mean, coming, you know, from the East Coast, it's like, you know, the person who follows Bill Belichick at the Patriots. This is, you know, in the first instance, this person is going to look like a modest character who lacks the legendary status of the people that came before. And Bernanke is a central banker of the new breed. I mean, he's a flat-out academic, a full wonk, which can't be said of Greenspan, who was more like a business analyst. But Janet Yellen was very much in that mode. Mario Draghi at the ECB in Europe as well. Ben Bernanke was an academic scholar, both of monetary policy, monetary economics, and of economic history, and had worked his way through the Fed system, Princeton economic departments. Really, a blue-blooded academic career. And what is really, I think, important, and it's a really interesting example of this, that it is also a case, I think, of somebody learning lessons from history. I mean, if Ben Bernanke has, you know, an intellectual godfather, it's Milton Friedman, the monetarist. And we think of Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, his partner in writing the monetary history of the United States. We think of monetarists as people who, you know, in the 70s and 80s campaigned to fight inflation by restricting the money supply. But the origins of monetarism in the United States are, in fact, the inverse problem, namely what happens if the money supply contracts because the banks aren't lending, and what you then get is deflation. And when you read the economic history of the United States up to the 1970s, the main problem was not inflation, but deflation. Collapses in banks leading to a reduction in the available money supply, leading to reductions in prices, the opposite of the familiar mechanism of more money chasing the same number of goods, leading to inflation, like, say, in Venezuela right now. Instead, what America suffered from was bouts of deflation. And the promise which Ben Bernanke made on the birthday, in fact, of Milton Friedman in the early 2000s was, you guys got it right. We were wrong. The Fed allowed the money supply to contract during the Great Depression. That will never happen again. And when Bernanke takes the reins, I think we have to understand that his principal focus as a central banker was to ensure that there would never be another Great Depression. And what he begins to see over the winter of 2007-2008, notoriously he's a little bit slow to really come to the game, but by the fall of 2007, I think he's beginning to size up the scale of the challenge facing the Fed. And what you see is an absolute determination on the part of the Fed to do practically anything necessary to prevent the banking system from suffering a collective heart attack, a total implosion, because that would have reduced the money supply and it would have caused prices to fall even more severely than they did anyway, and then we would have been in Great Depression territory. This really is an instance of somebody learning the lessons from history.
Well, and one of the things that you point out that maybe a lot of people don't recognize, people who are not studying economics closely, is that what Bernanke did went well beyond the United States. I think the number that you mentioned in your book is $4.5 trillion that the Fed pumped into banks in Europe and other parts of the world, and you use that as a very tangible example of how interconnected all of the economies are, which in some ways is straightforward, but in other ways is not. So Tell me a little bit about the shift in policy that went into his strategy and his willingness to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I think, the most remarkable thing that happens in 08, and it's one of the revelations, really, that I stumbled across doing the research for the book, and it's one of the stories that I hope the book will really foreground, is the realization on the part of the American authorities already over the winter of 2007-2008 that if they were going to save the American financial system, they were going to have to save the European banks as well. Why? Not out of some sort of misguided globalism, some aspiration to world dominance or a kind of calculus like that, but out of self-interest, because the European banks over the course of the 90s and the 2000s had invaded the American economy almost to the same extent, say, that Japanese car makers have invaded American markets for automobiles. European banks played an absolutely crucial role in the securitization of American mortgages. Something like 30% of the final stages of subprime securitization, when these mortgages were bundled up and turned into securities that could be sold, much of that, 30% of it, ended up in Europe. And that meant that the risks to the U.S. from the implosion of the banking system were not just risks from American banks collapsing, but were risks of European banks collapsing too. And so if you wanted to rescue the system, you had to rescue everyone. And they started simply by saying, well, we'll just treat any bank in New York, which has a legitimate registered branch in New York, as a bank, so we won't discriminate between American and European banks. And they did that on an enormous scale, well beyond the figure of $4.5 trillion that you mentioned. Trillions of dollars were flushed into Barclays, Deutsche Bank, Paribas, by way of New York. And then when they discovered that the European banks were running out of good collateral, these are not bailouts, these are liquidity actions where a bank has got some illiquid, owns a chunk of mortgages it doesn't want to sell, but it needs ready cash. The Fed will take those mortgages and give the bank ready cash. So it's a like-for-like trade, if you like, or a collateralized loan. The Fed is trying to minimize its risks. And when the Europeans run out of good collateral, the Fed says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to outsource the production of dollars to the European central banks. And they start doing this from December 2007. By September 2008, we're up to about a credit line of about $600 billion. And on October 13th, which is really the day of maximum crisis fighting, the Fed uncaps the so-called liquidity swap lines, which enable the European central banks to draw down unlimited quantities of dollars from the Fed. They can take dollars on demand. And to do that, what they do, all they're required to do, is credit the Fed with an account in the name of the Fed at the ECB to the value, say, of 100 billion euros. And in exchange for that, you get $115 billion over a period of a month, which you promise to pay back at a fixed exchange rate. So neither side has any risk. Both sides in the deal are collateralized because the Americans are holding the euros and the Europeans are holding the dollars. But at that moment, the Europeans are desperate for dollars, European banks, that is, and the ECB, by means of this swap line, is put in a position to basically provide them with all the dollars they need. So the Fed, one of the European central bankers at the time, said it was as though the European central bank had become the 13th branch of the Fed. It was basically a gigantic ATM for printing dollars. And it was no more problematic for the ECB to print dollars than for Bank of America or a regional branch, the San Francisco branch of the Fed. The Fed established a kind of worldwide network for pumping dollars out so as to prevent any European bank suffering a bank run.
So for those of us who don't follow the intricacies of, international banking, the Fed, all these pieces that were moving on, I mean, I think people, the gist of what most people took out of that, the crash I'm talking about, was that the housing market in the U.S. had collapsed.
Yeah.
A lot of bad mortgages had been packaged into these
Yep.
securities that fell apart, and then the government came in and essentially rescued what was a mess. And a lot of people were mad at the bankers who had caused a lot of this. That's a very, obviously, very layman's perspective. But what I was going to ask you is, so if you're viewing it in that context, What are you worried about, just as an everyday person who's not in financial services, so to speak? What are you worried about in terms of the economy and the way it's structured right now that lingers from 2008?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people are right now scanning the U.S. for new types of subprime. So they look at student loans, for instance, which have surged spectacularly over the last 20 years. You know, is that subprime? Or they'll look at auto loans, which have also gone up dramatically. Or to get a little bit more techie, they'll look at the so-called high-yield bond segment, which is corporate borrowers, businesses borrowing, essentially what used to be called junk bonds. So they're relatively risky corporate bonds, which reward the investor with a relatively high interest rate. And say the shale industry, for instance, the explosive boom in shale in Texas and so on was financed using the issuance of these kind of bonds. So again and again, people are scanning and saying, well, is that subprime? Could that be the new disaster? I mean, honestly, those are all very risky propositions, especially the high yield lending to American businesses. But is it the new trigger for a crisis? I think probably not. What it looks like to me is more like the sort of thing we saw with dot-com. In other words, a lot of people are investing in what look like attractive assets. Their prices go up. Everyone feels good. Everyone's getting better off. Wealth is being built. And then it suddenly demerges that the price, the things are overvalued and they collapse. And this causes economic flu, right? This causes a hangover. This causes the economy to go into recession. People spend less. They invest less. The economy slows down. We have higher unemployment. But it is not a heart attack. The question really is, if we're thinking about 2008, where are the heart attack risks? And the heart attack risks, I think, are outside the U.S. economy. If they're anywhere in the world economy right now, they're in China and East Asia. So China and Japan look like the most heavily leveraged economies, the ones where borrowing has been most intense, where China in particular rode out the shock of 2008 by pumping up demand like no one has ever seen before. It dwarfs the New Deal, let alone the Obama stimulus. It's a spending spree of a scale that we haven't ever seen before outside wartime. And they still haven't really come off that sugar rush. They're still not off that high. And you know, maybe the Beijing and, you know, the communist administration there is skillful enough to engineer a soft landing. But that, I think, is the really that's the big dark cloud over the world economy at this moment.
And I think one of the themes that I picked up in the book is for people who might look at this and say, well, if it happens in Asia or it happens somewhere else, just not in the U.S., we're protected as Americans. And one of the points you make is that no matter what you do, no matter if there's a trade war, tariffs, no matter what's going on, the financial systems are so interconnected that there, in essence, is no escape.
I think that's true. I mean, it's reasonable enough, I think, on the part of the Americans to say, you know, we have a degree of insulation. And even when things were very bad in 08, 09, it has to be said that the U.S. authorities, I mean, both the outgoing Bush administration and the incoming Obama administration, with a lot of personal continuity between the two, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, and so on, they actually did a reasonable job of stabilizing this situation. Obviously, we should never have been there in the first place, but when the going got rough, the American state administration actually had the resources to act. Now, whether that would be true under a Trump administration right now with a Republican majority in Congress is an open question, I think. But the Americans, to that extent, do have some reason for complacency. It's a huge economy, which is in many ways relatively insulated against world effects. But, and there's a big but, the way in which world economic changes flow back onto the United States is often extremely unpredictable. GM, for instance, right now sells more cars in China than it does in the United States. If China has a crisis, it's a crisis for GM. Apple's entire manufacturing system is based in China. America's banks have huge plays and entanglement with finance in Asia as well. So it's those kind of effects that we might see impacting the U.S. I don't think, however, right now there is anything quite like the phenomenon of European banks being major lenders on the American mortgage scene that we saw in the early 2000s.
Again, my guest is Adam Tooze. He's a professor of history at Columbia University, and his new book is called Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. As you are no doubt familiar, Economics is often described as the dismal science, so I have to ask you about your recent comments that you expect a recession within 18 to 24 months. Tell me why you're forecasting that, and how severe do you think it might be?
I mean, yes, I was quoted from some conversation I had with a journalist. It's not a matter of personal opinion, I think. I mean, there's a huge consensus out there in the market that it's really only a matter of time. I mean, America has not had a sustained upswing like this, possibly ever or certainly very often in its economic history. The sustained growth since 2009, slow and disappointing as it has been, is extremely unusual in its duration. So it really doesn't take any kind of forecasting genius to suggest that, there is likely to be a slowdown in the next year or two.
It can't just go up forever?
Amazingly, if you ask American consumers right now, it's really interesting. There's a fantastic survey, which is really quite sort of bamboozling when you think about it. But it asks people to contrast how good they feel about the economy now as opposed to how good they expect the economy to be 2 years out. And we are now, right now, at a peak spread between those two numbers. So right now, people are very happy with the way things are, as they are, as you've been saying, and yet they're quite pessimistic about the future. And that particular conjuncture of high optimism in the present and quite serious pessimism about the future is as good a predictor of a slowdown in the economy as we have amongst all the various indicators out there. So that spread suggests that, you know, there is a kind of wisdom of the crowd. These are big opinion polls done with very large and representative samples. It's as though, quote-unquote ordinary Americans are, in fact, just agreeing. I mean, we're all just calling the peak. We're all saying, you know, it really, at some point, we expect a change between the good times of the present, in economic terms, the relatively rapid growth, low unemployment, and so on, and some future scenario which is heading towards us.
That is Adam Tooze. Again, he is the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. We're talking about not only the 2008 recession, but what he sees ahead and how that recession still presents danger and warning signs for the months and years ahead. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Bank of America and Wells Fargo, two of the major players, obviously, in the banking sector, get his thoughts on how those banks are doing and talk a little bit more about how this has political ramifications. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins.
We cover a lot on Charlotte Talks, from the latest in politics and what's going on at City Hall to development, the economy, the arts, and interviews with newsmakers. But maybe there's something you haven't heard us discuss that you think we should cover. Well, now's your chance to have your topics and your ideas considered. Get in touch with us at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, and maybe you'll hear your idea on an upcoming edition of Charlotte Talks.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Adam Tooze. He is the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. And we were talking about the likelihood of recession when we went to the break. I wanted to follow up with you in this sense. I know it's impossible to predict, but we have to speculate anyway. How severe do you think the next downturn is going to be or is likely to be?
I think to come back to the point I've been making about 2008 and its uniqueness, the crucial difference, the difference to bear in mind is the difference between the heart attack and the bad case of the flu. I think what we're expecting is a bad case of the flu. I don't think what we're expecting is a heart attack. 2008 is heart attack, and those are very rare, mercifully, and that really hasn't ever been one quite as concentrated, massive, fast-moving, and international as what we were seeing in 07, 08. The Great Depression of the 1930s was terrible for unemployment, was terrible for agriculture. There were bank failures in the United States and in Europe as well, but there was nothing like those kind of panic-stricken weeks in September and early October. In fact, as far as Citigroup's concerned, all the way through to the end of November in 2008, where it really looked as though systemic actors were going to come down with a huge bang, and really take the entire system with them. So flu, I think, is what's on the horizon, and not heart attack.
So you talked a little bit earlier in the show about the Republican Party and how you believe it is very effective in terms of going out and winning elections and getting votes, but not in terms of the mechanical nature of policy and steering the economy in some ways. We have President Trump, who you talked a little bit about, and you mentioned his business career and some of the struggles he had had. So tell me a little bit about what your assessment is of the capability of the U.S. government right now to deal with financial shocks.
Well, I think it's a mixed picture, because as I was saying earlier on, you know, one thing I think that's predictable about Donald Trump is that he's self-interested and pragmatic and driven by a kind of, you know, he's driven by his inner demons and his ideas, no doubt. But I mean, the man does understand what it takes to save a business in a crisis. So at that level, you know, that isn't really my main concern, nor I would say is the issue of the Fed, where Trump has made relatively conservative choices, conservative in the sense of middle-of-the-road consensus-type picks. Powell as a Fed chair is a candidate one could imagine having been picked by Democrats. Indeed, he was, you know, one of the loyal foot soldiers of both the Bernanke and Yellen administrations at the Fed. So there again, I think that, you know, we don't see a huge change. I think at the Fed, at the Treasury, we've seen a watering down, an evisceration indeed, of banking regulation from within at the Treasury, which leaves one wondering about what level, if you like, of crisis-fighting grit would emerge from a place like that. The people who were running the American Treasury in 2008, 2009 had some pedigree in terms of crisis fighting all the way back to the 1990s. There will no doubt be staffers at the Treasury who have that kind of capacity. It's not really what one would expect from Mnuchin on the basis of his track record to date. But I think the real question mark is the GOP, is the party in Congress, because they are the piece that went AWOL in 2008. The Bush administration could not gather the support of the party, either for the receivership, the nationalization, effectively, of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or for TARP. And then moving forward from there, the Obama administration struggled to pass the budget and keep the federal government going in 2011. And in 2013, there was actually a shutdown, to the horror of commentators around the world, disbelief indeed. And crucial global policy moves like shifting the IMF quotas in favor of China, which is crucial to accommodate China and draw China in as a key stakeholder in the world economy, were blocked by Republicans who were using this for leverage over issues of abortion and the funding of abortions by Planned Parenthood. Now, whatever your position on that hot-button issue in American politics, from the point of view of global financial governance, global economic governance, the coupling together of a culture war issue in the United States with a structural adjustment in the governance of the IMF, on the other hand, is an indicator of a kind of, you know, politics of partisanship and no-holds-barred approach, which really does raise questions about the ability of the Republicans to underwrite stabilizing economic policy.
Let me ask you a little bit about the two companies I mentioned that are obviously major players and have deep roots here in Charlotte. Bank of America, of course, is headquartered here, and Wells Fargo, as I mentioned, bought up what was left of Wachovia and has remained here and has its East Coast hub here. So let's start with Bank of America. There was a report earlier this year that to date, B of A is paid somewhere around $76 billion in fines for mortgage fraud and other misconduct stemming from the crash. And then Wells Fargo, which was held up by many as an avatar of how to do things the right way coming out of the recession, has obviously had nothing but trouble here the past few years, including the sham accounts and all the changes with their board and limits on their assets. So how concerned would you be, not just with the broader picture for those two banks, but if you're living here in this part of the country and these are two major employers, what's the state of these two banks?
Well, I couldn't possibly comment on the business practices of of these two, you know, very complex organizations that, frankly, I'm not a bank regulation expert with precise knowledge of either of those two banks. If we go back to 2008, what is striking is how differently they're positioned. I mean, Wells Fargo at that point, it buys Wachovia because it wants the major East Coast presence. It wants that branch network. I mean, it starts the crisis as a West Coast actor. And at that point, as you're saying, striking the posture of a bank with clean hands because it wasn't involved in all the New York shenanigans, securitization and so on to the same degree. Subsequently, obviously, various types of malpractice have emerged. But structurally speaking, Wells Fargo was not in the front line of the 08 crisis. Bank of America was much more directly exposed and then becomes, if you like, the savior of Merrill Lynch. I mean, we too easily forget this. If Lehman had not gone down, Merrill Lynch would have. And it was really a choice between the two of them as far as Bank of America was concerned, and they took Merrill Lynch, and it was a disastrous takeover. I mean, it was politically engineered. It was rammed down the throats in the end of the Bank of America shareholders. And it was part of the sticking plaster which needed to be stuck on the American investment banking scene at that moment. Merrill Lynch just needed to be taken into the emergency ward as quickly as possible, and Bank of America took them there and kept them there. And that's really the first hit that Bank of America absorbed. Throughout, in fact, the crisis, Bank of America serves as quite a useful whipping horse. Would be too kind to the bank. But if you compare and contrast the treatment of Citigroup and Bank of America, it's quite striking because on the face of it, they look like similar large high street banks. They're not classic Wall Street actors. But the problem for Citigroup is, in a sense, it's in such a mess that the pressure the authorities can exercise on Citigroup is, in fact, not as severe as that which they're able to exercise on Bank of America. So Bank of America is forced to take more TARP money, to recapitalize more aggressively than Citigroup is. And then, as you were saying, it also pays enormous fines. No doubt, in their own terms, quite legitimate, but I don't think there's any question that they became a bit of a cash cow, if you like. If you were going to go after anyone, you were going to go after Bank of America, because they, in some sense, could absorb the hit, whereas Citigroup was just simply too fragile in the early phase of the recovery. So a long road back for both of these banks. In case of Wells Fargo, kind of they steered themselves into trouble. At this point, the good news for the residents of Charlotte is they're too big to fail.
There's that phrase again.
they're too big to fail. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine a world even worse than 08, 09. And, they didn't come out of that in the end fundamentally damaged. So they are actors with enormous leverage over the American political economy, which rode out one of the toughest storms. At that level, one has to feel that it's certainly, a relatively better projected position than the auto industry or something like that. Though AI, robots, and so on may change the business of service provision in ways we don't anticipate yet.
I want to ask you a general question, which is, I think this comes up a lot, which is so much of our coverage in the media or just general discussion of the American economy revolves around the stock market and the unemployment rate. In fact, I mentioned two of those factors as part of the recovery earlier in this show. What else should people be aware of to get a better handle on how the economy is doing?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, another thing we tend to focus on is the government deficit, right? The scale of debt. I think, things that really ought to be top of stack are investment and productivity. I mean, if you're interested in the long-run health of American society and the economy, the thing that we ought to be all deeply concerned about is the slowdown in productivity growth, because that really bears on what we're able to produce now, what our children and children's children will be able to produce down the line, because it's a cumulative process. The steps that we make are shorter and shorter every year than the rate of progress is slowing down cumulatively. And I think those would, for me, be the really essential variables in the U.S. economy for us all to focus on. And they also have very wide-ranging implications. What would be necessary to improve productivity in the U.S. well, better infrastructure, a focus, a relentless focus on education, widening access to education, making it more affordable, getting off the plateau that America has been on now for several decades with regard to the number of years of schooling that the average American receives, further widening access, not just to, you know, Ivy League campus type settings, but community colleges, various types of technical training, which are clearly crucial for the American workforce going forward. So I think that for me would be the number. The number of numbers is really the productivity number.
Those are the words of Adam Tooze. He is the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. He has a few more minutes with us. I'm glad you mentioned infrastructure. Now, I don't want this to be all about President Trump, but I am curious with infrastructure, and this predates the Trump administration anyway, it seems like such an easy political objective because it creates jobs, it's spending, it's nonpartisan for the most part. So why do you think this continues to be such an area of weakness for this country?
It's astonishing, isn't it? And it was one of the elements of his program that American labor could clearly get on board with. In practice, I think the devil's in the detail. The devil's in the detail, at least at two different levels. So how are we going to pay for this? What do we, in fact, imagine as the mechanism for delivering this infrastructure? Is it a public-private partnership? Is it just flat-out state or federal government spending? Or is it, in fact, as it turns out, I think the Trump administration really envisions its infrastructure program, which is basically a tax break for various types of private investment. That's where the rub is. That's where the partisanship enters in. And then the other element with infrastructure is that we'd actually have to decide on what the priorities are. I mean, we can all agree, I think, especially if you live in the, you know, the Northeast, as where I've been spending my time for the last 9 years, you know, this is mid 20th century infrastructure, if not even earlier, that's crumbling all around us. But then when you say, okay, I'd like to replace this with a brand spanking new, well, what? What is it we're going to replace it with? Are we going to make a commitment to high-speed rail? If so, what type of high-speed rail system? No, if we're going to replace the grid, what sort of power lines? As soon as you actually start talking turkey about the specific things you're going to build, the infrastructure problem becomes hugely complex. You have issues of NIMBYism, with no one wanting that gigantic solar farm in their backyard. The problem of government then becomes the problem of government, right, which is really difficult. You actually have to persuade people, bring them on board around certain projects. And that's where, again, the partisanship comes back in, because people have radically different imaginings of what a good future would be like. So we can all agree that the, you know, infrastructure is decrepit and we'd like more of it. But both on how to pay for it and what it is we actually need more of, the politics comes roaring back.
I wanted to ask you mentioned earlier the Dodd-Frank, the financial reform law passed in 2010. You described it as a hodgepodge. And in the book, you write about how there are a lot of missed opportunities with Dodd-Frank. So if you were made king of the world for a day, or at least king of the United States, and you could enact financial reform or policy change, what one thing would you want to do?
I mean, I think if we're going to go down the line of too big to fail, and if we decide that that's really our central focus, I think we have to address the size of this. We have to address the question of the size of financial institutions. In general, right now, the American economy suffers from giganticism, right? There is, you know, we were celebrating earlier on the size of Apple, which is great on the one hand and great if you own stock in the company. But from the point of view of inequality, from the point of view of competition, from the point of view of manageability in a crisis, the sort of scale which American enterprises are now reaching, I think, ought to be considered a problem as such. If you go back 100 years to the era of Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, bipartisan progressivism at that point on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, considered corporate power to be a central challenge for the American democratic system. And I think that question is still on the agenda. Indeed, it's, you know, more and more pressing. So aggressive action on the antitrust front, on the too big to fail question. There was open discussion in 2010 of simply putting a cap on the size of bank balance sheets, just simply force them to stay within a size of $500, $600 billion so that there were no problems larger than, say, a Lehman. These kind of measures, I think, where democracy would collectively draw a line and say, much as we celebrate private enterprise, we take the problem of power seriously, and we take the problem of privilege and inequality that comes with that power seriously, that to me would be where, you know, an agenda of progressivism might be laid out.
We will have to leave it there. Adam Tooze, the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.